Welcome to a special edition of the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser, chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto. It's with a heavy heart that we remember caver, cave owner, Dick Blenz, who passed away yesterday. Dick Blenz, of course, bought Buckner Cave back in the early 60s, and he allowed everyone on his property and in the cave, and it's a great cave. But because of that, it kind of gained a reputation as a party cave, a sacrificial cave. It was full of trash. Then it was cleaned up in the mid-aughts, spray paint, sandblasted, and now looks pretty good. The fact that Buckner is one of the most famous and infamous caves in the world is all because of Dick. And, of course, he donated it, so the NSS owns the property, and it's managed by the Richard Blenz Nature Conservancy, whose president, by the way, is Anmar Mirza. You may have seen him on the news lately. You've been brought on by a number of news outlets as an expert on cave rescue, given the situation in Thailand, which thankfully had a happy ending for everyone, except for that former Thai Navy SEAL Saman Kunan, who collapsed and passed away in the cave. Anyway, Anmar has done great with all of that news cycle surrounding that event, and of course, leading the National Cave Rescue Commission, and of course, leading the Richard Blenz Nature Conservancy. But it wouldn't have happened without Dick Blenz and his love for the cave and his desire to share it with the entire world. Now, I'll admit that I'm not exactly qualified to memorialize Dick Blenz. I'm only 35. I've only been caving for 8 years, and I don't even do that much to begin with. What I wish is that I were one of those people who hung around the barn in the 70s and 80s before it got torn down. I wish I were part of the Monday night group with Anmar, who goes in there every week for exercise. I wish I'd spent more time with Dick and all of his contemporaries. I want to talk to more of the Sullivaneers, the ones that are still around, who spent 2 weeks mapping Sullivan Cave with Dick. And we talk about all of this in this conversation you're about to hear. I'd love to go caving more often than I do. And honestly, if I had to pick one cave to visit for the rest of my life, I would hate to make that decision, but it would probably be Buckner Cave because it's just so fun. It doesn't flood. It's pretty safe. It's got a little bit of everything. And if it weren't for Dick, the NSS probably wouldn't have as many members as it has. I mean, let's face it. That many people have been through Buckner Cave and got their start there. So to so many people who are still caving, Buckner was their first cave. And, you know, if you have the 2007 National Convention Guidebook back underground in Indiana, if you came to Indiana for the 2007 convention, dig up that guidebook and read the article Don Paquette wrote about the barn, which used to be on the Buckner property. You know, given the news about Dick, it'll probably bring a tear to your eye. Even if you didn't know him and even if you've never been to Buckner, that article really captures that feeling of camaraderie that people got being at the barn and at the cave and with Mr. Blenz. It was just sad, you know, to get that news yesterday. So the best that I can do is repost his interview that I did with him. We sat for 3 hours one morning just over a year ago, and he laid it all out. I'm so glad to have gotten his story on tape from his perspective. A quick note, because I'm moving and still unpacking at home, I don't have access to my home computer where the original edit for these interviews lives. And I wanted to get this out today, and so I had to cut it from the finished episode material. And so you'll hear some of the waterfall sound effect in the middle that I used at the beginning and the end of the interviews on the podcast, which that waterfall was recorded in Buckner Cave, by the way. But that sound effect marks the separation between part one and part two of the interviews, which were, of course, released in two parts last summer. So that's what that is when you come up to it. So here it is, the one and only Dick Blenz from May 2017.
Well, how'd you get started in caving?
After the war, I went back to Purdue and didn't last very long. I decided I didn't want to be an engineer for various reasons. And because I was an experienced technician, I'd rather do it that way. And while I was at Purdue, in our house that we were living in, one of the guys in the house came up to me one day and he says, you have a car. I had a Model A Ford. And he says, you have a car and I have a family in southern Indiana down here. And I'd like to get down there and get some good dinners and things. And let's go down.
Okay.
Okay. His name was Johnson. So we drove down, and his father said, you guys ought to go caving.
What year was this?
It was about 1952, 1953, right in there someplace.
Yeah.
So we went over to Spring Mill State Park.
Ah.
And climbed around in the cave over there. And, hey, this is a good deal. You know, I, oh, great. Wow. And that started it. And I started caving a little bit, but not very much. And I quit Purdue and came home while I was in the north end of the country of Indiana, and there ain't no caves near that place.
No, no, no.
So I fooled around from 1954 all the way into the 60s, worked with my father in the store and maintained the televisions and things that come, and I was doing a lot of that work. And one day, my mother was looking in the Chicago Tribune, and she said, hey, there's a job offer here at the University of Chicago. You ought to try for that. She always thought the University of Chicago was actually one of the top places in the world to even be associated with. And she was out of Chicago area. So I said, oh, golly, I don't know if I can qualify for that kind of a place. The University of Chicago was considered one of the top-notch universities in the world, especially on research. And she says, oh, call them up. All right. So I called them up, and the guy asked me if I was experienced. And I said, yeah, I have radar and all that stuff. He says, come in and get an interview. Well, I didn't know it at that moment, but he was the man that ran that whole affair at the Enrico Fermi Research Institutes.
Oh, wow.
One of the leading professors in the world in cosmic ray research and stuff.
Yeah.
And he says, come in and get an interview. I says, well, I better be honest with you. I said, I do not have a degree from a university of any kind. I have a lot of experience. And he came back at me, and he shocked me. He says, I am surrounded by degrees around here. He says, I'm looking for people who can do something.
And here you were.
I said, well, I can do something. He says, come on in here. And I went in and interviewed, and 2 weeks later, he gave me the job. I was with them for 11 years and doing high-altitude cosmic ray research from balloons and things. And it was a beautiful, excellent job. I loved it because I got to fly. I got to fly on airplanes, and I got to recover balloons and do all kinds of crazy things, both here and in Canada. When I joined the U of C, they had something like 6 Nobel Prize winners on the campus.
Wow.
Simultaneously.
Wow.
They consider themselves as a Nobel Prize factory. They still do. And their attitude was, you get your PhD here at Chicago, then go away. Go away. We don't want you here. Get a job someplace. When you earn your Nobel Prize, come back.
Come on back.
And that's a big plus for a university.
Well, I guess so.
They had a whole bunch of them. And finally, about a week after I got to the University of Chicago, that was the first of 1955. Somebody come to me and they said, you're from Indiana, aren't you? I says, yeah. He said, there are caves down there, aren't there? Yeah. He said, you know anything about them? I said, oh, I've been in a couple of them. He says, let's go caving.
And there we go.
And here we go. And we came down. We started coming down here. And we finally formed the Windy City Grotto.
So you helped form the Windy City Grotto?
Yeah, I was one of the instigators of it.
Wow.
And that was in 1961. Mm. And the NSS had been around since the turn of the war, from 41.
Yeah.
And so we finally decided we ought to join the NSS, and we did, and started the grotto. Of course, we were coming down here, mostly here and Central Illinois and Missouri and some into Kentucky and once in a while off into Tennessee. And I decided one day we were building a new building on the back of our facility at Chicago, and they had to close the place down for a weekend on a Friday because they were about to wire the new building into the old building, and it concerned handling 12,000-volt equipment, and so they shut the whole thing down so they could do it. And they suddenly announced, you got a day off with pay. Because the power's going to be off and there's nothing you can do here. So I come down here, and there was a little house across the street on the other side of that fence.
So you came down little, you came down here, exactly
yeah,
here.
So I thought, well, I might as well go down there and see, go caving.
Sure.
So I came down here, and I was sitting in that little house over there,
mm-hmm.
and there were no fences or gates or anything on any of this. This property had been essentially abandoned. We didn't know who the owner was. We didn't have the foggiest notion. The next-door neighbor, two doors down now, was told to keep everybody off this land. Well, he didn't own the property, and he wasn't too interested in that, but anyway, he was told. And so Buddy Rogers, who was a part of our caving system, had his house three doors down. So we would pull into his place and come across the forest and go caving.
Ah, okay.
And I came down to just look around the community and look around and look for holes and stuff, this, that, and the next thing. And I was sitting on the front porch of that house, and all of a sudden, two cars pull in, a car and a pickup truck. And they pulled in and they stopped. And what attracted me was the fact that one of the cars had a big sign on the side of it that was advertising religious revival. And I thought, what in the heck is this all about? And they got out and they parked their vehicles and they walked off onto this property. And they were gone, and I was sitting there wondering what was going on. Who were these people? Well, I'm not the nosy type. You know, I didn't own those property, but I'd been in the caves many times. All of a sudden, they came back out. And something, one of these impressions that I get very rarely, but once in a while, that can change your life.
Mm-hmm.
And an impression came across me, said, get nosy. Okay.
Okay.
So I went out and I says, what's going on? And the guy spoke up and he says, oh, I'm the owner of this property. Whoa. Aha. Uh-huh. And he says, I'm the owner of this property, and I've been trying to sell it for 6 months, and I don't seem to be able to move it. So I decided to sell some of the timber on it. Well, it turns out that he's a preacher in Crawfordsville, Indiana, up halfway between Indianapolis and Chicago.
Sure.
And why or how he was, to this day, I don't know how or why he ever owned this property. But he says, so I decided to sell some of the timber, and this fellow with me was a pickup truck from a timber firm that was here in Ellettsville. And he had come in to look at the timber, and they were looking at trees. Well, he said it was for sale. My brain started to churn right away. And I suddenly says, what do you want for this place? I figured it would be an outrageous price because he couldn't sell it. And I says, what do you want for this place? And he says, it is exactly 50 acres. Give me $7,000 and you can have it.
Which, with inflation, is about 40 grand today?
I don't know.
Yeah.
He said, give me $7,000. I want $1,000 in cash, and I'd like to have an income once every month just to add to my income at home. So I thought about that for about 20 seconds, and I said, sir, you just sold this place.
1961, 62?
This was in 1962.
Gotcha.
And I said, you just sold this place. And he looked at me and he smiled. And the guy next to him, he didn't smile. And he looked at me. He says, would you be willing to sell the timber here? I says, no, I think I'll make a project out of it of some sort. I said, no, no way. So he got disgusted. He got in his truck and he drove away.
Oh.
And there I was. And right, so I says, I told the preacher, I'll hunt you up in Crawfordsville and bring you a check, so on and so forth. So he was about to leave, and he said, oh, I better be honest with you. There's a big hole on the back of this property that may affect your wanting it.
You bet it does.
Yeah, I guess. I says, it's okay. It doesn't bother me. I didn't tell him that if that hole hadn't been there, I wouldn't have been here. I wouldn't have had anything to do with the property. So that weekend, I went home up in the Calumet, and I announced to my father that I had just bought a 50-acre piece of property. And he said, it's about time you did something with money. And I didn't have very much money.
Mm-mm.
But I got a loan from the bank, and next Monday I went down to Crawfordsville and searched him out and gave him a check. And it was about 6 o'clock in the afternoon, and he was real happy about it. And he said, I'll call my lawyer. And he called the lawyer, and the lawyer says, meet us over at my office right now. This was after supper. So we went over to the lawyer's office, and they had all the papers made out, ready to sign. I signed. I became an owner of the property. And when it was over with, I hadn't thought of this, but when it was over with, the preacher asked the lawyer, what do we owe you? Uh-oh. And the preacher says, oh, give me $10. The lawyer says, give me 10 bucks.
All right.
So I got this place for 10 bucks. And that surprised me. So I started coming down here and for 4 years.
Living in Chicago, coming down here to K.
Coming down here about twice a month.
Mm.
And it's a 400-mile trip, you know, all down here and back and all that. I was wearing out automobiles. So one day, we had a day off for some reason or another. So I came down here, thought, well, I'll go caving. Brought a couple of guys with me, and we came down. Got down here, and it was raining like hell. And I thought, oh, heck. Suddenly, I had one of these impressions came across my mind.
Another one.
And the impression says, why do you have to work for the University of Chicago? What's wrong with working for Indiana University?
Right down the road.
And I thought, you know, that's not a bad idea. That I suppose that was in the back of my mind because, after all, I had bought this place. So it was raining, so I went back into town and hunted up the personnel department. It just happened to be in a store building across the street from the main entrance to the university. So I got parked, and I went into the place, and I says, are there any electronics jobs on this campus? He says, yeah, we have about 10 electronics shops on the campus. I says, well, are there any jobs ever available? He says, one came in this morning, a request. And he reaches over, and he picks up the card. And he says, this job came in this morning he says, I don't know anything about it, excepting that it's the physics department.
All right.
So I walked out. He took me out to the front gate, go up there and find out what this is all about, and I'll know more about it myself. Okay. So I goes up the physics building, roamed around. I had never been in the place, roamed around looking for an office or something, finally came across an office. I walks into the office, and there's two ladies sitting there, secretaries. I says, I have a slip here for a job offer. And she looked at me, and she said, boy, that was fast. Usually it took them weeks, you know. She said, that was fast. She said, I'll take you into the office. Dr. Langer was the chairman of the department. And I went in, and he shook hands with me, and he sat me down. He says, you're an experienced technician? And I says, yes. I gave him, you know, I was in the Army and all that. He says, who do you work for? I says, the University of Chicago, John Simpson. And his eyes lit up like two light bulbs. His eyebrows rose right away. He said, oh, yes, we know of Simpson's work. He got up, and he walked to the door, and he called one of his secretaries. He said, would you call John Simpson at the University of Chicago?
Uh-oh.
On the telephone. And I thought, uh-oh, what am I getting into?
Calling the boss.
Shortly, the phone rings. He picks it up. He was faced away from a at his desk, and they were talking. He talked on that phone for 10 minutes, and he was writing things down on a piece of paper, and all of a sudden he hangs up, and he turns around, and he says, you have this job if you want it.
You're all set now.
I says, but for once in my life, I was speechless. And I says, well, I haven't talked to Simpson or anything at Chicago. And he says, I think Simpson knows all about it. What a way to get a job, to have your new boss tell your old boss, you just quit. Well, Simpson was extremely happy about that. He was the sort of a leader that never tried to hold anybody back. If you could do something better, fine, great. So I went back and I resigned my job, and he sent me off with celebration, and I came down here. But I got my job because I had worked for the University of Chicago. That was all it took, that word, U of C. So I had my job here and moved down here. And then in 1974, my father was a builder and decided, I want to build my last house right here.
1974,
we finished this place.
Oh, okay.
75, actually, 74. And Dad and I built this house with our own bare hands. This house cost me $16,000 for the materials.
Wow.
$16,000. When I took it in to have it insured, it took 2.5 years for us to finish this place. I took it in to have it insured, and the insurance company said, it's worth $60,000. I said, well, this is a neat way of making money. Well, I wasn't about to sell it.
No,
I was going to live here.
And you haven't yet.
So I had started developing this place for caving.
Let me ask you about the cave itself. I mean, what about Buckner Cave do you just love? I'm sure there's a lot of things.
Buckner Cave has been known for a long, long time. When we first went in there, the place had been marked up quite badly. And
in the early 60s, it had already been marked up a lot.
And there was a so-called signature room, which we don't call it that anymore.
L.V. Cushing room.
And on the ceiling, people had put candle marks to identify. And there was two candle marks, which are still there. And one of them was, they were just names of people.
Yeah.
But it was dated 1835.
Wow.
That's 16, 15 years after the state became a state. And we thought, this is neat. So we took those two names. Somebody took them into the courthouse and searched through the records to find it. And it turned out one was a county coroner and one was a county sheriff. And what they were doing back in Buckner Cave, I have no idea. And in those days, lighting and stuff was
very primitive.
Open torches and things.
Yeah.
And so the cave has been known for a long, long time. But it essentially had been closed up, sort of. It has a large entrance room, big enough, about 4,000 square feet of floor space in that place, with 30-foot ceiling that you can walk down into.
Mm-hmm.
From there is a crawlway for 698 feet. And then it opens up into essentially 3 miles of walking around passageways and things.
Mm-hmm.
Crawlways and climbs and
a little bit of everything.
A little bit of everything. but nothing dangerous. The cave is not a flutter.
Drains very well.
A very, very rare cave that can be declared a non-flutter. In fact, we warn people, be exceedingly careful, because that's how we drowned. That's how we end caving.
Right.
We've had 5 deaths in Indiana on our records, and they were all drownings.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just 2 instances of caving. So the cave was very nice to have because it was a good cave for training.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been doing that. And at one time, we were getting 5,000 people a year in here to go caving. And the whole idea was to develop a facility to train people into caving. And I think we gained a lot of people for the NSS. Many years later, I was at a convention in California. We have a national convention every year.
Sure.
Someplace in the country. And this was within California. And somebody came up to me and they said, I started caving in Buckner Cave.
Like so many others.
Yeah. And I looked at him and he says, where are you from? He says, Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I says, well, how come you were in the Buckner Cave? He says, well, I happened to go to Indiana University. And he says, you can't escape caving when you're in Indiana University.
Uh-uh.
And so he joined the Grotto and all of that. So we added a lot of people to the caving fraternity, and we still do.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that you've seen every part of Buckner Cave?
Oh, yeah.
You've been in
many
part of it.
Many times.
Yeah.
There's a lot of little side passages, and you never know when you're going to find something new.
Yeah.
Caves are funny.
Yeah.
We had surveyed and mapped that cave, I think, for the 4th time. And suddenly one day I went caving with 3 or 4 guys who wanted to go, and I thought, well, I'll take them around the circle route.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been in there?
Oh, yeah, many times.
Okay. So we go into Buckner. At the end of the crawlway, you walk. If you go right, you go down to the stream. You go left, you go around the circle route.
Right.
So we decided to go left. I was walking along, and all of a sudden, a guy disappeared. I noticed he wasn't there. And what the heck's going on? So I turned around and I walked back, and I was yelling, and suddenly I get a voice coming from a hole in the ground. There was a little ledge you climbed down off of, and he had noticed the rock, and he pulled it out, crawled in there. He found new passage. It's on the maps.
What was that on the map? Do you know?
It's just a unnamed passage. It's just a crawlway, and it has water in it and so on, and it goes back for quite a ways. It's a fairly long little passage. Actually goes underneath the entrance crawl. And
it must be Gurgling Spring. Is that what they call it? Gurgling Spring?
Yeah, that's Gurgle Spring.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Yeah, you're well acquainted with it. yeah, that was it.
I've got the map of Buckner, Sean's new map. I've got it blown up on my garage wall, so I stare at it all the time.
Okay, fine. I keep forgetting you're a major caver.
I wouldn't say that, but I would say Buckner is my cave, like my favorite cave, the one that I visit most often.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the cave can grow.
Yeah.
You never know. For instance, I took a couple of guys in, and we did the circle route, started it in. We got to the big room. You have to crawl up and go into a crawlway. Well, you can go to the left, and there's a passageway, but it finally terminates.
Yeah.
But you can walk through it. I got over there, and we walked down that passage. And all of a sudden, again, there was nobody behind me. This is what happens when you take inexperienced people, newcomers to the cave.
Mm-hmm.
They get nosy.
Yeah.
They look at everything.
Sure, as they should.
And we old-timers kind of forget about that. You know, we go through the cave, and we really don't see it anymore. And suddenly there was nobody behind me, so I turned around and walked back, and I yelled out, and I got a reply from up in a hole in the ceiling. And what the heck is this all about? So I goes up there, and here's a room. It's an empty room up above a pile of breakdown. And you can sit up in there. Two or three people can fit in there real nicely. And he was up there, and he was sitting up there, and he'd seen this thing. He climbed up there to see what was going on. And we have that named.
Keen's Grotto?
Keen's Grotto, yeah.
Okay. Was he Keen?
His name was Keen.
Okay. I've always wondered how these rooms got their names.
Yeah. And we found that and put it on the maps.
That's great.
So I've been in every possible corner of the cave. You can go downstream, follow the river, and finally it'll get into a long passage, mm-hmm. the river passage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a tough passage. It's walking, fairly narrow, but it's got little bridges across it. And you have to climb over them or go under them or some darn thing. And finally you come to a waterfall.
Yeah.
And you go down the waterfall about 15 feet.
Yeah. We'll climb
down.
You
can follow the cave for a while, and then finally it closes down too low.
Mm-hmm.
We often remarked about that place because if anybody ever got injured in there, we would figure how we would ever get them out.
Yeah.
In a stretcher. You know, it'd be almost impossible. We'd have to have a doctor come in and do the servicing.
Mm-hmm.
But we had that passage there. And explored the cave all over the place.
Mm.
I like to do things that are unique.
Of course.
I'm the prime one person in the entire country that knows, is supposed to know, where every cave in this nation is and a description of it.
That's amazing.
There are many people that, like the CIG, that carries the state files and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm the only person in the country that has the whole damn thing. I'm one of 11 people who spent 3 weeks in a cave.
Mm. Wow.
Sullivan.
Oh, mapping Sullivan. Yeah. I just did a trip to the Rise in February.
All right. The year before, there had been an expedition of teenagers decided to go down and explore and map the cave. And they stayed for 2 weeks. And they made quite an expedition out of it and succeeded in producing a pretty good, quite a bit of map and so on and so forth. The next year, they decided, let's do this again.
Sure.
And finish up the problem. There was a lot of work that still had to be done. And Sam Frischauer.
He drew the map.
Said, let's join that.
Yeah.
Okay. So we went down, and this was for 3 weeks. We spent in Sullivan Cave, got beyond the beyond, got into the northern part all the way to as far as we could get.
Yeah.
Did mapping and surveying for 3 weeks. And so I'm a member of a very unique organization, the Sullivaneers. 11 people.
Yeah.
There are cases in the country where individuals have stayed for a year in a cave by themselves. Been two or three of these have occurred. But nowhere has there been a case where 11 people as a large group stayed for that long.
Yeah.
We are now getting surveying being done, one survey being done, and some people have been down for 2 weeks.
Lechuguilla?
Things like that.
Okay.
I'm not sure whether Lechuguilla or that could be part of it. So I got that on my record. 3 weeks in a cave. And we came out, we went in on August the 10th, 1963. And I had my birthday down there on the 21st is my birthday. And we came out 3 weeks later at the end of August And Armstrong came down and brought a
Bob Armstrong.
Yeah, Armstrong. A hearse. He collected hearses.
What?
He collected all kinds of things. If you ever want some interesting, look into his history. The man was absolutely crazy, but he was a great caver.
Yeah, yeah.
And but he lived up on the north side of Indy.
Yeah.
He brought a big hearse down, a pink hearse.
What?
And we all got into that thing. We all had beards. I had a beard. I'd grown for 3 weeks down there. And a bunch of other kids, and we all had our helmets on. And he had a cannon on a trailer.
Yeah.
And it was hooked to the back of this hearse.
Yeah.
And we drove all the way up to Indianapolis and drove around through town with this thing and looked at people's reactions. The craziest nonsense ever. And it was funny. Policemen and stuff never even noticed it. It was strange how reactions we got from that thing. That was how that all ended.
Mm.
And we had taken exams and stuff, mental exams and everything, and they looked at the results to see what our attitudes and things had changed, and it was quite involved.
Yeah.
So I was a part of that nonsense. And that cave, Sullivan still promises to go.
Oh, I know.
But going beyond that water entrance is going to be a tough one.
Yeah. Beyond the rise at the very back?
At the far end where Sullivan River comes into the cave.
Yeah.
And up to that point, the place is a borehole.
Yeah.
I can drive a freight train through some of it.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether anybody will ever push that thing or not. It'll take a major project.
It would take a lot to get equipment back there to try to dive it.
Yeah. But we had fun with it. In 1974, about the time I finished this house, my father died suddenly from a heart attack, and my mother wanted to go to Florida to stay on the property that they had owned down there. And so I took her home. I took her down there to stay. So I was at a caver get-together at Caver Valley down south.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, Tom Ray, who was the chairman of everything in the world.
Caving related, yeah.
Tom Ray come up to me and he says, "How would you like to be the National Cave Files archivist?"
Sounds like a big job.
I said, "Well, it sounds good." I says, "What does it consist of?" He says, "Answering questions and keeping the records for files." So I said, "Okay." So a few weeks later, I wasn't living here yet. This wasn't here yet. I was about to move here, but Mom and Dad had moved down to Highland Village here to be 200 miles closer to Florida, which they spent all winter in. And so I went back. I was living in Highland Village here, and suddenly 6 filing cabinets shows up. So I was in the cave files business. There is now 16 filing cabinets filled in the basement right
down
here.
In the basement right now.
And I am still the National Cave Files archivist. We have something on the order of 59,000 caves on the books right now.
Whew.
I have them all right here on this computer and in paper downstairs. And the NSS has suddenly decided to expand, and they had moved to Huntsville, Alabama, and a couple of years ago they decided they would expand, and they bought a new piece of property down there, a new headquarters. And so I went down and took a look at the place, and they decided to conglomerate all services to the new facility. I am still waiting for them to call for the national files.
Do you hear
We're
that?
All still waiting for this.
You hear that, NSS?
When are we going to do that? Because that's going to be a major move. We got 16 full loaded filing cabinets plus other equipment that's got to go to Huntsville, Alabama.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a box truck out Eller Road. Make it happen.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens. We're officially waiting now for them to make a move to decide how they're going to want to move all this stuff and the whole procedure for it. So I'm hoping that because I'll get a new basement available.
You have all kinds of room. What are there some other caves? Around? I mean, there's plenty of other caves around here.
Yeah.
What were some of your other favorites around the area, Garrison Chapel area?
The next cave north is Wayne,
mm-hmm.
which is still the longest cave in the county.
Yeah.
About 4.5 miles of it. Have you been in there?
Yeah, I have.
The tough crawlway?
It is.
Yeah. Finally, the cave was bought by
IKC.
So it's protected. But there was Wayne's and there was Salamander,
mm-hmm.
Coon and Grotto, and gosh, I can't think of them all. And there's about 360 caves in the county.
Yeah.
And I have it all right here on the computer. And this does not rank us number one in the state by a long ways.
No.
Harrison County down on the river
mm-hmm.
Has, I don't know, 500-600 caves in it or something. And we are on what is called the Crawford Upland that crosses the Ohio River near Leavenworth. And as it moves, it stretches north. At Leavenworth, it's about 35 miles wide east to west. It's a ridge of limestones that's sitting above the base rock. And as it moves north, it gets narrower. Down there, it's about 35 miles wide. Up here, it's about 6 miles wide. And when Caves of Indiana was published, we had, I think that had 398 caves in it. It was essentially everything we really knew about, mostly on the Crawford Upland. There are now 3,300 caves on that same area. The upland goes north up to Greencastle,
mm-hmm.
and then it dips under the overburden from glaciers.
Yeah.
And on the Crawford Upland, there's probably 2,700 caves.
Mm.
And then there's a small upland to the southeast, Muscatatuck or something they mm-hmm. call it. And that's got about 400 or 500 small caves in it. Nothing major. So most of it is on the Crawford Upland.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you go south into Kentucky, it spreads out and on into Tennessee. And Buckner Cave sits in the same rock that Mammoth Cave sits in. The area is a very extensive one.
Mm-hmm.
And the rock extends all the way over to Missouri.
St. Genevieve limestone.
Actually, the St. Genevieve limestone got its name from Missouri.
Yeah.
And and that's what we have here underneath us. Many of the hilltops, including this one, have a sandstone cap over the top. Here it's about 35 feet deep.
Mm-hmm.
And this house is sitting on sandstone.
Mm.
If you go out across the road here and walk down the hillside, you'll come to a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
That's the sandstone cliff.
Ah.
And underneath that is the limestone sticking out. And the water coming down gets charged with carbon dioxide from all this coverage, becomes carbonic acid, flows off to the edge of the sandstone, drops into the limestone.
Carves it out.
Cave.
Yeah, there you go.
We used to go down roads on the Crawford Upland. We used to go down roads and stop about every third farmhouse. You got any caves around here? Yeah, there's one up on the hills behind the barn. I'll have my kid take you up there. And we'd go up there, and I'll be darned if there wasn't a cave entrance. And the farmer knew about it, and he put a fence around it to keep his animals out of it.
Sure.
But otherwise, nobody knew about it. And we found a lot of holes like that. There's caves all over the place. So we used to do a lot of that. Well, that sort of thing has been going on the eastern part of the country. Missouri, of course, on the west of the Mississippi, but just barely. But I've calculated here, of the 59,000 caves that we have in the country, two-thirds of them are east of the Mississippi River.
Really?
Include Missouri on that.
Yeah.
Even though they're west. But Missouri and all the rest of the country, two-thirds of the caves are east of the Mississippi. The rest are west and are spread out rather all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
The number one cave state is Tennessee.
Of course.
I have 10,360 caves listed in Tennessee.
Wow.
They have one county. They have one quadrangle sheet. There's something like 300 caves on that sheet.
Wow.
And they come under the rules that were set at TAG, the TAG area.
Yeah.
Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia.
Yeah.
They have the rule set that if a cave is not either 30 or 50 feet deep or 50 feet long, they don't count it. And this is 300 and some caves in on a quadrangle sheet.
That they are counting.
That are counted.
Amazing.
And you wonder,
yeah,
where do they have space to put a house? They don't, really.
They don't, no.
And that whole area down there is like that.
Wow.
And it stretches from Maine down the Appalachian system and into the Ozarks.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what we've been searching over for many, many years.
Yeah.
And I think we're finding them.
Yeah.
This is a problem because out west, things are still going pretty strong. It's a big country out there. Americans don't realize how big this nation is. And west of Kansas or something, the amount of space is fabulous.
Yeah.
And a lot of it has caves in it.
Mm.
Not so much down in Kansas and Nebraska, no. But as you get back into the mountains, yeah.
Yeah.
And I was sitting here one day with the National Files, and I get an email from Belsky. Belsky is the guy who takes care of the files of New Mexico. He sent me a list of 20 new caves. I got them up there. 20 new caves. I thought, well, that's neat. You know, wow. So I dutifully put them on the file and forgot about it. About 4 months later, he sends me a list of 20 new caves. Hey, that ain't the same list.
We got 40 new caves.
Yeah, what's going on? So I got on the email and I said, what are you doing out there? What's going on? I mean, in Indiana, we ain't going to find a new cave in the next 10 years. And he says, this was in the summertime, and he says, it's been fabulously hot down here where he was. We've been going up into the mountains to cool off, and guess what?
We're finding caves.
We're finding caves. He says the areas are abandoned terrain, which nobody has been in for years.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier, miners went out to look for gold and what have you, and the Indians had abandoned the place. And he says it's just empty country. Miles and miles and miles of it, of valleys in between mountain ranges and stuff. He says, it's surprising how much of this country is really isolated.
Yeah.
And he says, we're finding caves. Well, he's added over 100 caves. I get a list from him every once in a while now.
Wow.
And it's just automatically, he puts it in. They've got 2,800 caves in the state now.
Wow.
And, of course, Carlsbad Caverns and things are major ones, but they're still finding stuff. And then they found Lake Egilia, and that was a major, major find. Here's a little hole blowing 40 mile an hour wind.
What in the world?
We got to look into this one. And all of a sudden, it's 125 miles of caverns.
Amazing.
Ranking second or third in the country, you know. Caving is interesting. You get to a place like South Dakota. North Dakota has seven caves. North Dakota's a big state.
Yeah.
It's twice the size of Indiana.
Seven caves.
South Dakota is a big state.
Mm-hmm.
South Dakota is caveless, except...
Except?
For four little counties in the southwest corner.
And there...
It's... All the rest of the state is useless for caves.
But
and
that's
that southwest corner.
Oh, yeah.
There are two caves in one county, Crystal and...
Jewel?
Yeah, Jewel. Jewel and Crystal. Those two, that county has maybe 200 caves in it. And none of them particularly, you know, they're nice caves and stuff. They got caves, but fine. They got nothing spectacular, particularly, except for these two. And they are world-class caverns.
Yeah.
Over 150 miles each.
Still being pushed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And still being pushed and ranking two in the world virtually, you know. And you wonder, what's going on out there? You know, where they throw the averages all cockeyed, you know, suddenly.
Yeah. Here,
you think, boy, South Dakota has some real cave. They ain't got nothing except for that corner.
But those are amazing.
Yeah. This is an amazing place. So we had a convention down there on one of our cavers' communities. In fact, my red shirt came from that convention.
Ah.
And so it's still an interesting area, and people are still trying to push those two caves, which is getting very difficult because it's a big project every time you try to do something. The interest in caving is not there as it used to be. Kids are now stuck on their little machines.
Yeah.
I don't own one. I'm an electronics specialist, and I don't own one of these damn things. I don't have one of these phones.
Yeah.
I just don't want to be bothered by it. But these kids, complete computers, I will admit, these little phones are remarkable computers.
Of course.
Absolutely astoundingly remarkable. And they're getting better and better. You know, here you have a really up-to-date computer sitting in your pocket. And I don't understand some of it, you know, how they manage to do this. The technology has essentially up and left me sitting here with transistors. But... it's really remarkable what has happened.
Mm-hmm.
And the NSS numbers, we were up, we got just over 10,000 people. It is now down to 9,000 something.
Mm.
And you're not going to join the NSS to be able to go out and find a cave.
Mm.
There ain't none to be found.
You're going to join to do it.
So what we're trying to do is to get people interested in preserving what we've got.
Yeah.
And mapping it and surveying it and looking at it and protecting the wildlife and the bats and whether you can get people into caving with that kind of an interest, I don't know.
Mm.
But I think what has happened is that we have actually, as far as Indiana is concerned, has essentially caved it out.
You think so?
There's obviously possible caves. Things show up.
Sure.
Witness the big hole underneath the car museum in
in Kentucky. Yeah,
I went down there when that occurred. And amazing, absolutely astounding what happened and didn't kill anybody.
I know.
God, you couldn't have made this happening on purpose.
No.
Planned any better. But anyway, we have had in Indiana essentially six grottos from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
Always the CIG, the BIG a little later, and others have shown up. And then, and I help add the Windy City Grotto to that. The fact that we found 3,300 caves in an area that had 300 and something, 400 caves, it's been pushed pretty hard.
Yeah.
And we're getting to the point all over the eastern end of the country that we've essentially found everything that's worth finding. Something may open up, and on occasion does, and you have to be ready to look at it. But this business of walking out over the country and finding a big cave is not going to be easy anymore. Part of the cave is right behind the house here.
Yeah.
30 feet down.
Volcano room, right?
The volcano room is between the house next door and the one next door to that. It's between those two.
Mm.
And it's down there about 130 feet. In fact, the house two doors over had changed hands, and they wanted to drive a well.
Ah.
There is no water. There was no city water out here then. And so they didn't consult with us. They just went ahead and drove a well out behind the house, and they hit empty space. And they had to, they hit something like 16 feet of empty space, and they had to put in casing and all that stuff. If we had known where they were going to drill, and we had accurate maps by that time, we could have pushed their well 20 feet over, and they would have been in rock all the way home. But they didn't. So you can go into Buckner Cave, into the volcano room, and back there in the corner, you'll see the well pipe.
I've seen it.
Yeah.
I've seen it back there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we could have saved them a lot of time and trouble.
Yeah. it didn't really end up, did it end up working as a well for them?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
it did?
Yeah,
okay.
It still is. And I don't know if they still use it because they brought water out here finally, but not here. I'm not on the water line. The water line ends 20 feet the other side of my boundary.
Of course.
Wouldn't bring it up. So I think they went off to the water supply, but I'm still on a well.
Mm. You dug a pit into the volcano room.
Oh.
And you were thinking about building down in there.
I'm one of the designers, the original designers of the radio cave mapping system.
I wondered about that.
The magnetic system.
Yeah.
In 1960, I was at the University of Chicago. There was an industrial magazine in this country for the electronics industry.
Mm.
And we would get a copy of it every month. And actually what it was new ideas and new things coming out and advertising jobs and all this stuff. And we opened it up that day, and it had an article, Mapping Caves Magnetically.
I'm interested.
Well, this was interesting.
Yeah.
And, of course, I understood what they were trying to do as soon as they described it, you know. I said, well, yeah, I guess you can do it that way. So I thought, well, why don't I make one of these damn things? So I went to my shop at Chicago, and I had a good electronic shop there, and I sat down, and I built the first one.
Ah.
And years later, I learned that the guy, some guy named Sheldahl or something, I forget, was an electronics person at Naval Avionics in Indianapolis. And why he wrote this article, I don't know.
Mm.
But he wrote it and it got into electronics. And later on, I learned that he had never been in a cave. He was not a caver. But anyway, he wrote this thing. Yeah, he wrote this thing. Well, I built the thing and used some of his technology, but transistors had shown up by that time, and his stuff was in vacuum tubes.
Mm.
So I modified things and so on, and finally came up with the unit, and we started bringing it down here and doing survey with it and so on. And I had that thing. In fact, the transmitting antenna is downstairs here in the basement, the first one. And I finally came down here, and we were doing surveys with it. And one day, the state of Indiana decided to buy Wyandotte.
Mm, right.
Make a state recreational area out of that thing. Wyandotte is a very famous cave.
Sure.
Been around for a long time. They decided that they wanted to put electric lights in the big cave.
Mm.
Across the entrance from Wyandotte is Little Wyandotte, and that was all commercialized. Big Wyandotte was commercialized, but when you went in, you carried a lantern, and they wanted to modernize it. So they wanted to put electric lighting into Big Wyandotte. So they went to Naval Avionics, and they said, we'd like to have a survey made of the cave to find out where to put power lines in.
Mm-hmm.
And they described the problem. And Avionics said, no way. They quoted a price which was outrageous, and the state decided against that. And so the state then went to Purdue. Purdue has a survey system, you know, teaches geology and so on and so forth.
Sure.
Went to Purdue and they described what they wanted. Went to their civil engineering department. Said, we would like to have two holes driven from the surface into two rooms about a mile apart in the cave. And we'd like to get a survey made from those rooms out to the surface and back over the top to find out where to put a drill. And Purdue took one look at that job, and they said, impossible. They said, we'd have to use optical survey going over hills and dales and around the inside the cave for a mile or two back.
Well, yeah.
And then come out and then do it on the surface and get it to come out exactly.
Yeah.
They said, we don't think it's practical. So now the state was, what are we going to do? Well, there was a man here in Bloomington.
Ah, yes. Dick Powell.
Dick Powell. Richard L. Powell was working for Indiana University as a coal geologist. But he was highly interested in caves.
Yeah.
And he wrote that book finally in 1961. Well, Powell was here, and he had surveyed Wyandotte Cave
mm-hmm.
with a plane table system. The plane table is a flat table sitting on tripod with telescope on it and paper, and actually you would draw the map as you went through the cave. And when you came out, you had a map of the cave.
Wow.
A line map of the cave.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful technique, but you got to have some space to work with.
Sure.
Well, Wyandotte, plenty big.
Yeah.
So he had done a survey. He knew very accurately what that cave looked like, its layout. So the state knew about that. So the state came to him. And they said, we'd like you to show us where to put the two holes to bring down power cable. And Dick says, I can't do that. He says, I know very precisely to the inch what this cave looks like, but I don't know where it is. It's somewhere in that hill, but I don't know accurately where it is.
Yeah.
And then he said, but I do know a person who can find out. And he gave him my name.
Ah, of course.
So I actually signed a contract with the state of Indiana. And Dick Powell and the manager of Wyandotte went into the cave with my radio transmitting system, magnetic system.
Yeah.
And I picked a guy named Larry Townsend, who was working at IU in the cyclotron, and he was a caver, and I says, we got a job to do.
Yeah.
So we were on the surface, and we finally found the spot. and it was about 360 feet down, and we just barely made it.
Mm-hmm.
But we did find a spot, and we put a big mark on the ground and put an X and drill here. And then at the same time, we went a mile further and found a second spot. And that took quite a bit of time that day to do all of that.
I bet.
And so then the state went out and they hired somebody to come and drill holes. And we told them, set your drill up and make sure that it's absolutely level, that it's absolutely square with the ground, and drill exactly where we tell them. Okay. They thought this was kind of strange, but oh, well. They went ahead and they drilled on the first one, and they broke into the cave. We had had a mark on the ceiling that our transmitter had been directly underneath,
mm-hmm.
as to where they wanted to come through. And it was a small room back there someplace. Figured that was a good place to bring the power box. We got in there. They finally went in to see where the drill had come in, and they couldn't find it. They had actually they knocked the mark out of the ceiling.
It was that close.
And later on, the driller, he said he was astonished. He says, I can drill 6 feet in any direction in per hundred easily.
Mm-hmm.
He says, it's just the nature of the thing.
Sure, sure. Makes sense.
And he says, we knocked out the thing in the ceiling. They went to the second hole, and they missed the mark by about 6 or 8 feet, but it was still in the room. So that was fine. No problem.
Yeah, yeah.
About a month later, I got a letter from Purdue University.
Who said it was impossible.
And essentially he said, how did you do that?
I'm not telling.
That made me feel real good.
I bet it did.
And how did you do that? I said, well, we didn't do it with optical instruments, believe me. We did it with electronic. That didn't make them very excited.
No.
But I think they paid us $1,200 for that job, and I paid everybody off. And they brought out Highline, this 7,200-volt line out to the two holes, put in transformers, and ran entrance cables down into the cave, and they put lights in all over the place. And they didn't do a very good job, but it's illuminated.
Sure.
So that was my experience with the state of Indiana.
Well, so did you then use that to figure out where to dig to get into the volcano room?
Oh, down here?
Yeah.
We had used the cave mapper to find out exactly where Buckner Cave was.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of side passages and things in it. So we decided to find out where the little volcano was exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had drawn a map. The map was quite accurate, and they had put it down on the quadrangle sheet. We had a blown-up quadrangle sheet, and we accurately put it down on there. And a potential entrance was way out on the east side, just over Buddy Rogers' land.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a big sinkhole over there. And so they had put the map down, and we had located that sinkhole accurately over there, and that was on the maps. So they laid the map of the cave on it and photographed it and all, and we thought we knew where the volcano room was.
Sure, little volcano.
And the little volcano and all that. So we put a transmitter at the little volcano,
mm-hmm.
and at that time it was just a lot of mud coming in through the roof,
mm-hmm.
and I went out with the receiver to find out where it was. The map showed that where we were going to drill was across the road, and about 200 or 300 feet off that way.
Yeah.
So I went over there and waiting for the transmitter to come on, and all of a sudden it came on, but it was way out of line. I mean, what the heck? So I did the things to try to find out where zero was, and I went working around, and suddenly I was standing where the hole is right now. And I said, I'll be damned. We made a mistake on the map.
Yeah.
So later on, we took the map and anchored it at the hole on the at the east end and just physically rotated the whole map. And that thing moved right into position. And so we knew precisely where that entrance was.
Sure.
So we decided, well, let's make an entrance.
Yeah.
So we started digging, and we finally broke into it, 35 feet deep, and it came down into the volcano room.
Perfect.
And so we opened up the pit. We did a lot of digging and put a ladder in, and we had an entrance to the cave. And then I thought, you know, it would be neat to have a house down here. It enters into the of the volcano passage, and it's big, and it's high, and it's dry.
Yeah.
And it's got a nice flat ceiling, and there's plenty of room to put a house in here.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, I'd like to try to do that. So that was the idea at that time. About that time, my father, he got interested in the place. He actually climbed down the ladder. He was getting pretty old by that time. He was getting to climb down the ladder. Well, you got quite a place down here. Came back up. And he suddenly said, I'd like to build my last house for you here on this property. And he says, but I do not want to put it underground.
Okay. Well.
Well, I was getting contractor's prices and and a lot of help. And so I thought, well, okay. So we built here. We let that go down there.
Yeah.
And finally it collapsed in.
Yeah.
And because we didn't have it secured. But we were, I had plans for putting an electric lift and all, the whole thing in there.
Sure.
But it never worked out.
Do you ever think about the way you would have done it if you had decided?
Oh, yes.
So how would you
have
done it?
We had full plans about the house and how to build it. One of the big advantages was that it's 54 degrees down there.
Sure. Natural insulation.
You could put a heat exchanger
in
there and pump the cave and heat the house.
Yeah.
And it would be real cheap, because when you transfer heat, that's cheaper than manufacturing it out of electricity or something. Mm-hmm. Much cheaper. And it turned out the whole thing planned out to be quite practical.
Yeah.
I still think it would be practical to live down there. And but you were underground, and actually we would have had a way of exhausting house air and so on and so forth. But the cost of doing it was really minimal.
Yeah.
And the cost of maintaining it would have been really minimal. In fact, I even went and somebody interviewed me on television in Indianapolis about this thing.
At the time?
And so I got on national TV about it. But Dad decided against it, so that was the end of that.
Oh, man. So would it have been, I'm sorry I keep asking about it, it's just something that really interests me. So would you have just kind of built a small structure in there? Would you have incorporated the rock wall? Would you have just put up walls in certain areas? And
oh, no. I would probably have used one wall of that room as a wall in the house.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of it would be lightweight construction.
Mm-hmm.
Well insulated, so that your heating would be very effective.
Sure.
And don't know. It was just a neat idea.
I think. Yeah.
And but we just didn't do it.
Yeah. Would you have closed off the volcano, the big volcano, so that no one could come into the volcano passage?
Oh, no. No.
Leave it
that
open?
That would have been all open.
Yeah.
That would have been an exit from the house if you ever had to have it.
Of course.
And, no, it's at the end of the long, long passage, you know, the volcano room itself, the volcano passage itself. It's still a very interesting area of the cave.
Oh, yeah. I love it back
there. It's an upper passage. It's an upper cave.
Yeah.
That collapsed into the lower cave.
Long
at
trunk
the volcano
passage.
Room.
Yeah.
So it is dry, and it is a very nice area.
Mm-hmm.
Plans and all would work out.
Yeah. So when did the abuse of the cave really start to kind of get out of hand?
What?
Too much spray paint, too much vandalism. When did that kind of really start to get out of hand?
We started to worry about it pretty early, but how are you going to prevent it?
Yeah.
And finally, it became critical when we're going to say, well, we're going to give this to the NSS.
Mm-hmm.
We ought to give them something that's halfway decent. And so we made some changes.
Mm-hmm.
People would try to clean the cave a little bit, but it was a big job. And we were telling people, you know, you bring out your carbide and so on and so forth. But in those days, even we would go in with carbide and dump it.
Yeah.
But cover it up with soil and dump it. But and then we finally was requiring people to bring carbide out, you know, and it was interesting. We had next to the parking lot down here, we had we drilled a hole in the ground with a post hole digger, and everybody would dump their carbide in that hole, and then when it got filled, we covered over the soil and drilled a second one, and all of a sudden we discovered the grass on top of that hole is absolutely gorgeous. It likes it.
Really?
And it turns out that carbide is a good fertilizer.
Oh, my goodness.
So then we said, well, what we'll do is have people spread it thinly along the road.
Okay.
And then the water will wash it off into the sides and fine. It does no harm whatsoever.
Huh.
And concentrated is a poison, but so is a lot of things.
Yeah.
Concentrated oxygen is a poison if you get enough of it. And so that was our policy, that people would drop their carbide along the road. And then finally modern lighting began to show up, and carbide was no longer the way to go. But I did a lot of caving with carbide.
Yeah.
And you carried a bottle of water and a bottle of carbide and a
you got light.
And this was all done in little baby bottles that kids used to drink out of.
Yeah.
And you carry a bottle of hard candy.
Yeah.
And that was caving in those days.
That was caving. Can I ask you about Doug Love and his book? And you're putting your head down and laughing. So his book kind of created some problems around here.
He created a lot of problems. In fact, I think it was the cause of three deaths.
Yeah.
Almost positive.
Yeah. And was that the salamander incident?
Yeah. Salamander. When the three guys, when the three people died in Salamander.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of other vandalism, of course, too.
I had to go in there and get their bodies out.
Oh, you were there.
And, Doug Love suddenly showed up. I forget all the details.
He wrote the Spelunker's Guide to the Garrison Chapel Valley, yeah.
He wrote books.
Yeah.
And
published them and
put
them in.
He gave exact locations.
Exactly.
Of everything.
You could buy the book anywhere, almost.
Yeah. And the book was in every store in town and all of that stuff. And we considered it dangerous as hell.
Yeah.
Well, the three kids that had drowned in Salamander had read that book.
Yeah.
And had been attracted to Salamander. And they just came in at exactly the wrong moment.
Yeah.
And they drowned.
Yeah.
And finally love went off. I forget all the details. We've tried to forget him.
Sure.
He went to the East Coast, and he got a job doing something out there, and finally he has disappeared. But, no, we were very unhappy with Love.
Do you think it was his? You think it was his fault for a lot of the vandalism in Buckner Cave too?
Very likely.
Yeah.
In the general area, because we didn't. We were getting to the point of not publishing exact locations.
Yeah.
Up to a certain time, that was normal. Every time you published something about Buckner Cave, you had its exact locations in quarter form.
Yeah.
Quarter.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's longitude and latitude because we have satellite now. And a lot of people didn't know how to handle quarter system.
Yeah.
Very luckily, it says, for instance, the northwest quarter of the southwest quarter, and it's just written like that, northwest, southwest, southeast, section such and such, township and range.
Sure.
Okay. A lot of people, huge numbers of people, didn't know how to handle that, because between the two words, northeast, northwest, are two words that do not appear. Of the. So that means when you read this direction, you read it backwards.
Okay.
The last one is the first one.
Ah.
So a lot of people went out looking for cave.
didn't find him.
didn't understand what was going on. But a lot of people did understand it, and we worried about it because, for instance, out here on Garrison Chapel Road, there is a cave back, it's probably a mile and a quarter from here. There's a cave back, sits off the road quite a ways. It was just a hole in the ground, and it had clear, clean rock in it. Obviously got wet occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
We got in there and we surveyed it, and it broke out into a tall crevice. What was remarkable, at the top of the crevice were logs that had floated in there, got to the top of the crevice, got stuck.
Yeah.
Dangerous as heck.
Yeah.
Absolutely deadly cave.
Yeah.
We calculated that an inch of rain would flood that thing to the top.
Wow.
And so we picked some day in January when it had been freezing. You know, the ground was absolutely solid.
Yeah.
And went in and surveyed the place when the water was down. And but it was things like that. It was on that book of his.
Yeah. Ah. So
and,
it was.
And that's all we would have needed, is somebody get in there, you know. And there are a lot of those. We always tell people caves are made by, nature makes them by running water.
Mm-hmm.
Once in a while, she comes back to check her work, and you had better not be in there.
Yeah.
When that occurs.
Yeah.
Buckner Cave being somewhat of an example of it.
Yeah.
Of it doesn't flood, but that's rare.
Yeah.
And so you should always expect a cave to be a flutter and to have problems like that. But Doug Love did us no favors.
No.
And we were finally to get rid of him because he did cause a lot of trouble.
There were a number of rescues in Buckner Cave. And
dozens of them.
Yeah. And when I imagine being the owner of the property, you worried a lot whenever there was a rescue.
Generally, people would go down and not have sufficient light.
Mm-hmm.
Light to a caver is the same as a parachute to a diver.
Sure.
You'd better have it, and it had better work.
Yeah.
We had numerous rescues of people who would go in and get confused and run out of light, and we'd go in and find them down there. Okay, fine. We had one major rescue. You've probably read about it.
The volcano room?
I was sitting in this house. In fact, I was asleep. telephone rings. I answered it, and it was the state police.
Mm.
This was 6 o'clock in the morning
on
a Sunday. And they said, "We think you have a problem in Buckner Cave. Somebody has come out and has said there's somebody injured in the cave." I says, "Thank you for calling. We'll look into it right away." The state police, over the years, have learned that they don't want no part of this. we convinced them of that when the three kids drowned in Show Farm Cave. The two kids drowned in Show Farm. They went down there to do a rescue and ended up, we did the rescue, and it wasn't, we did the body recovering.
Yeah.
But the authorities decided they were not positioned to take care of cave rescue, that the cavers were there. And this is an unusual thing in the country. And so anytime there's a rescue call comes in, they call us immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll help. You know, they come out, they do all kinds of things. But to do the actual rescue, no way. They let us do it.
Not cavers.
And I was in the house, and I get the call from state police. So I said, "Okay, I'll look into it." So I gets up, and I walked back to the barn, which was there.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a car parked. It was still kind of dark. And there was a car parked there, and I went up, and I opened. There was a couple of people in it. I said, "What's wrong?" They said, "We just got out of the cave, and there is a man lying at the bottom of the volcano room, obviously injured.
Mm-hmm.
We've left one of our people down there with him, but we're going to have a rescue."
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So they told me about that. All right. So I walked back up to the house, and I get on the phone. Well, we have a rescue list, and so I start down the list. Don Paquette was the major rescue person. So I calls Don. I says, "We got a problem." "Okay." So he said, "I'll be out." So he came down. Well, I was in the house calling people, and Don comes sailing past the house, and he goes back to the barn, and these people told him the same story, only they added to it. And they said, "The guy who's down there, his buddies are up here in a car on the other side of the barn." They didn't tell me that. His buddies had gotten out of the cave, and they were in the car.
What were they doing in the car?
Well, it turned out that these three guys came to Buckner Cave for the express purpose of going to the volcano room and getting drunk.
Ah, there was a lot of that.
And they took the whiskey in to do so.
Yeah.
Foolishness, I can't understand it. This kid that was in the cave was not a kid. He's a 30-year-old man with a family at home in Indianapolis.
Mm.
And he's down here. And the people that were in the car said, "We found him about 3 o'clock this morning," and they came out of the cave, and instead of stopping at the house here, they went around looking for some place to call sheriff, and they got down here to a gas station out here on the highway, and they called the sheriff, and he called me. So, meanwhile, knowing that we were going to have a problem, the rescue started. Knowing that we were going to have a problem, I thought we better call a physician. So we got a hold of Indianapolis.
Methodist Hospital?
At Methodist Hospital.
Yeah.
And I says, "We've got a rescue. You better come a running. It looks like a bad one."
Yeah.
"Okay, I'll be down." So he gets in his car and he starts for Bloomington. And meanwhile, our people decided, "We may have a problem."
Mm-hmm.
If you go into the Buckner entrance room, on the left side where the crawlway, well, that used to have a big pile of rocks, big rocks around it. And you almost had to, we knew that, we had actually discussed this earlier, that given the need for a straight stretcher, we would have had a hell of a time getting that stretcher up those rocks and into the main entrance room.
Yeah.
we think we better do something about that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, by that time, the state police had sent a car out, and they would guard the front entrance to make sure that nobody should get in here that wasn't supposed to be in here. Because when word spreads about something like this, you can have the whole community over here.
Sure.
And so I walks out to the front gate, and I asked the cop, and I says, is there anybody around here with a air hammer system that can break up rock? He says, how many do you want?
You're all set.
I says, get a crew out if you can.
Yeah.
Okay. About an hour later, a crew appears with a compressor and the whole darn business, and we manhandled the whole thing down to the entrance of the cave and ran hoses in.
Wow.
And they sat there, and three guys sat there and hammered away on rocks to open up that thing a little bit. Meanwhile, Sloan.
Neil Sloan.
Yeah. Dr. Sloan come down. He got here. And he's a prime caver, world-class type.
I met him in December.
Yeah. Well, he got his training as a medic in Texas.
Ah.
And he was authorized as a medic to do emergency work, like out on the highways and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So he was well acquainted with this sort of thing. And he got his degrees, and he finally got assigned to a hospital. And he said, I learned something. He said, first of all, the hospital is run. Any hospital is run by anesthesiists. He says, I didn't know that.
I wonder why that is.
And so he went back to school and became an anesthesiist. He said the reason was that, he says, anytime I want to go caving, I just announce I'm leaving for a month. Yes, sir.
All right.
And he liked to go to exotic places like France and you know, wherever it was caving.
Yeah.
And he's a prime cave diver.
Wow.
He knows that game, too.
Wow.
And and he would like to go cave diving and all this stuff. So he came down here. He crawled into the cave. He says, I was 20 feet from the victim, and I knew what the problem was. I had a drunk on my hands.
Oh, boy.
He said, I could smell it.
Wow, 20 feet away.
And the guy was unconscious or something at the bottom of the volcano room.
Had fallen down.
They were up there drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Two of them decided to come out and managed to make it.
Mm-hmm.
He fell off the edge of the volcano room, tumbled down, hit rocks, and broke his back in three places.
Oh, wow.
And was lying at the bottom of the volcano. And just as luck would have it, this other group was in the cave roaming around at that hour.
Wow.
And came across him. Talk about luck.
Yeah, no kidding.
And they came up and they started the whole thing. When our people came down to start the rescue, we had electronics people. They ran a telephone line from the entrance of Buckner's all the way to the volcano room.
Wow, that's a long way.
All the way to the bottom of the volcano.
Yeah.
When Sloan got to his patient, he said, I was pretty sure I had a back problem.
Mm.
He was able to get on a telephone and talk to Methodist Hospital direct.
Amazing.
And we had run a phone line all the way to the entrance that converted to a transmitter that went to a repeater at IU, and that repeater put it on the telephone system, and that went to Indianapolis. He sat in that cave 3,000 feet back from an entrance.
Yeah.
And ordered a helicopter, the Lifeline helicopter, in from Indianapolis.
Wow.
To come down here to the airport.
Wow.
Meanwhile, we called on the local hospital, and they sent out two ambulances that sat here all day long waiting for
him to get out. And the Red Cross came out and served up food and stuff. And, well, morning comes. Pretty soon, somebody went to these two guys that was asleep, opened the car up. They were
hungover.
hungover. And he said, "Don't you know that a man of yours is injured in that cave?" "Oh, he'll be all right." And they went back to sleep.
Oh, my goodness.
Finally, they woke up. Here's 100-some people standing around here, cavers and rescuers and ambulances and all the rest of it. And they got the story of what was going on. And they decided, well, he wasn't going to need the car. So they pulled into the car and pulled out. And we, to this day, don't know who they were.
Really?
Nice friends to have.
Yeah,
huh?
No kidding.
They never stopped to wait for him to get out or anything. They just left.
Oh, my goodness.
It was late afternoon when we finally got him out of the cave.
Mm.
It was a long haul.
Yeah.
Difficult. Down that crawlway and all.
Yeah.
Finally got him out, brought him up here, and they put him in ambulance and hauled him off to the airport, and they took him directly to Methodist up there. And when it was all over with, everybody was standing around talking about all this. Suddenly somebody come up to me, said, "Aren't you worried about getting sued for this?" Gosh, I never thought about it. And I said, "I don't know." Dr. Sloan was standing there. Dirty clothes, you know, he looked like a caver.
Sure.
And Sloan spoke up and he says, "I was called on the telephone about 5 o'clock this morning out of my girlfriend's bed to go on a cave call to go into a dirty old wet mucky cave to rescue some drunk." He says, "I make $100 an hour for what I do at Methodist Hospital."
Yeah.
He says, "Most physicians won't go next door on a call anymore, leave alone drive 50 miles out of his girlfriend's bedroom to go on a cave rescue." And he made it sound like, gosh, this was a terrible thing.
Yeah.
Actually, he enjoyed it.
Well, yeah, of course. But
I know he was a prime caver.
But this was an ordeal. And so, you know, yeah, even if he enjoyed
and it. And so he says, "If I ever charge this guy for services, he'll never pay it." And the guys that were on the air hammer had come up, and they were standing there, and they said, "Do you know what it costs on a Sunday morning to have," and they underlined the word, "to have a union air hammer crew come out and pound away for hours in a cave?" "If we ever charge him, he'll never pay the bill."
He had a lot of people to thank for getting him out of there.
Yeah. And the ambulance people that were standing here said, "Do you know what it costs to have an ambulance stand by for all day?"
Yeah, much less air.
Yeah.
Air support.
So the next day I took the whole program into my insurance that I had covering, and he took on a look at it and he said, "Don't worry about it." And I have never heard one word from them.
Mm.
They just, I think my insurance agent called the guy's insurance agent and read them the riot act.
Yeah.
And he is a paraplegic in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. And he was a 30-year-old man with petrol at home.
Mm.
What the hell is he doing? People can be so stupid, it is absolutely understandable. That was the only big rescue we ever had in Buckner.
Yeah.
A lot of little ones.
1983? Is that when it was? 1983?
When did that happen? Oh, boy, I don't know.
I had heard early 80s.
You might be able to find a record. I forget just when we did that. I probably have it on here someplace. A lot of times you get funny rescues. We got a call all of a sudden. Somebody says, somebody's stuck in the volcano room. How can you get stuck in the volcano room?
It's enormous.
Well, he was a 240-pound man.
Okay.
They had done the circle route, and when you get underneath the volcano room, there's a big pile of dirt coming down out of the volcano.
Yeah.
And then there's water. And if you don't do the volcano, you'll have to go through the water on your belly.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side is the river. It was beside you there, small stream.
Mm-hmm.
They had gotten into that far, and he decided to go up into the volcano. He got up onto the big pile of dirt and pushed his shoulders through the hole going up the volcano and decided his ass wouldn't make it. So he tried to back out, and his shoulders wouldn't make it.
Oh, no.
And there he sat.
Oh, no.
On this pile of dirt, unable to go either way. So they brought up, they called a rescue. Somebody come racing out. We got to have a rescue. Described what was going on. So we took some shovels in and we dug the dirt out from under him, and he fell out and everything was fine.
Okay. Yeah.
So we made a rule. If you weigh over 240 pounds, you shouldn't go into Buckner's circle route.
When was the last time you were in the cave?
I don't know. It's been about 10 years since I've done a circle route.
Yeah.
After about 10 years ago, 8 years ago or so, my knees decided they'd had enough of this nonsense. And I can't bear down on them strongly anymore. And so I haven't been down the Buckner. I go down into the entrance room and we have a Halloween party or something down
nice.
There. But to do the crawl away no more.
Yeah.
And but if I get into a commercial cave, I'm fine. I go caving. So I haven't been down through the whole system for quite a while now. But that's because I'm getting older.
Do you miss it a lot?
Oh, yeah. I spent a good part of my life down there.
Yeah. So Buckner was resurveyed a few years ago, and Sean Lewis drew the new map. Do you like the new map?
The present map?
Yeah.
Was just done.
Yeah, a few years ago.
I don't know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago.
2012.
I don't know if there's a date on it or not.
2012.
Okay.
Yeah.
Suddenly some of our people said, we ought to map that thing again. So they did.
Yeah.
But they were using modern equipment, you know, lasers and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it turned out that they, really there was no corrections to be made much.
No.
They added a little mileage of stuff and made some minor corrections here and there. But they did draw a nice map.
It's a great map. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that was good. But... Buckner Cave.
I came down for the mock rescue that Don Paquette and Anmar Mirza and all them did a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite memories from that weekend is seeing you standing by the map at the shelter and just looking at it.
Yeah.
And me and Charlie Vetters from the CIG got to talking later, and we thought, what is he thinking? Looking at that map, what is he think? What is Dick Blends thinking as he looks at that
map?
Yeah,
because I'm familiar with every piece of it.
Yeah.
You know, I've been there.
Yeah.
It's neat. I started Indiana University on March the 1st, 1966. I worked for them for 40 years to the day, to the hour, because in 2006, on February the 28th, which was the day before March the 1st,
yeah,
I resigned. I retired. And I was there 40 years to the minute. If I had come to work the next day, I would have started my 41st year. And I was the chief of the electronics shop, physics department, for most of that time, and had a great time. I've been very, very lucky.
Mm.
I've spent my life doing my hobby, and so it's never been... I would just as soon be at the university on Monday morning as to be at home, because there was always something to do, to play with.
Yeah.
So in 2006, I retired. And then in 2008, I decided I was getting older and I would like this place to remain caving.
Mm-hmm.
And so I gave it stock, lock, and barrel to the National Speleological Society. They own this house. They own this property.
Wow.
Outright.
Wow.
I have a life estate agreement to stay here for the rest of my life. And, otherwise they own it. So we began to build, we replaced the barn. We built a facility back there. And, finally, when the NSS took over, we had to put some restrictions on. And so the gates and you register to come in here. And so we, began to restrict who was coming in. Meanwhile, we thought just before the NSS was to take over the cave, we thought we ought to clean the place.
Mm-hmm.
I met a group in California at a convention, a grotto of some sort, whose hobby was to going around cleaning caves. And they had a big industrial air compressor system on a tractor trailer.
Sandblaster, right?
Sandblasting.
Yeah.
And we demonstrated that thing on a big rock outside of town. We cleaned all the paint off of it and everything. And I thought, this is neat. So I asked him, how would I get this thing to Bloomington? Albuquerque is not in Bloomington.
No.
and the equipment, they were from Albuquerque. And they said, tell us when you want it. We'll bring it out.
Mm.
So we worked up the idea of it and finally told them a time and date. They brought that whole rig out here and left it for 2 years.
Mm.
And we cleaned Buckner Cave from end to end, and we're still doing it.
Yeah.
The equipment went back, finally. They had miles of hose. They could run 3 sandblasters simultaneously at the end of that system.
Wow.
And we cleaned Buckner Cave from all entrances. And we took 6 layers of paint off the signature room.
Oh, wow.
down to the rock. And the cave looks much different than it used to, but it's back to the way it ought to be.
Yeah.
Of course, now we watch that people don't do that. You know, well, now it's people registering and so on. And they've been told what they can do and what they cannot do. And anybody coming in has to sign one of these things.
Yeah. The release and waiver of liability agreement.
Yeah. So we're still doing it.
Yeah.
Our visitation level now is down to about 1,500 a year. For some reason, cavers feel comfortable.
Yeah.
In a cave.
I certainly
do. Some people are terrified, you know, in the cave. I've had people, I'm claustrophobic. That's the last thing that a caver is, claustrophobic. In fact, I've been in things so darn tight, you wonder if you're going to get out of here or not. But, there is a group of people like that. Of course, there's a group of people that like to jump out of airplanes, you know, and
takes
and
all
like
kinds.
To rappel and so on and so forth.
Sure.
And I'm of a group that likes to go caving. I do not enjoy vertical work.
No.
It's a lot of unnecessary work. In fact, Dick Powell is of that, too. He says, I vertical work, if it doesn't lead to a cave, to heck with it. But vertical work is important because of the pits and things that we have in Mexico and so on.
Sure. I got one last question for you.
And it's a question that I like to ask everybody who I get to talk to, and everybody kind of answers it, gives me similar answers, but everybody's got their own kind of spin on it. And that is simply, why do you think you like to do it? Why did you like to cave? Why do you like caves in general?
I think it's something that's built into you. Don't tell my mother, who's long dead, but anyway, we lived in Valparaiso, Indiana, back in 1930. We lived in a huge house, a mansion. Mm. It was a 16-room house.
Wow.
Four people living in a 16-room mansion. Dad tried to buy it in 1929, and we moved into it. It had a huge area underneath the front porch. It had huge areas otherwise. There was a little entry, and I used to climb in there and get under the front porch and look at things and look out through. And don't ever tell my mother. She would have had a conniption cat fit of the first order. But I enjoyed being in a place like that. I don't know why. I think it's just something that's somehow built into you. There's some people who enjoy doing certain things, you know. I was kind of born that way, I guess. I don't know.
Hmm.
Because there are people who wouldn't get caught dead in a cave.
No.
Oh, down in a cave, no. The devil down there. So I don't know. The fact that there are only 10,000 members in the national organization, and that number hasn't really grown over the years since World War II, our population has almost doubled, but our population in the NSS hasn't doubled.
Hmm.
We are a unique sort of people for some reason. I don't know why. You are one of them. Why do you like a cave? I don't know. You go into a cave and you suddenly feel very comfortable. You know, there aren't very many people who would want to spend 3 weeks in a cave.
I don't know if I'm one of them.
Wow. We had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah.
You have to have that peculiar mental characteristic, I guess. I don't know what it is.
Hmm.
My attraction to electricity is a peculiar mental capability. Very fortunately, I followed it, and it's been the success of my life.
Mm-hmm.
But some people get into doing other things, you know, and they become experts at it, and they enjoy it, and so on. Some people enjoy digging holes, you know, and they go out and they dig holes for buildings and and all that. They like to run bulldozers, and there's other people that like to jump out of bridges and jump off of cliffs and do all kinds of things.
Yeah.
And there are people who like to just sit in their room and play on a computer all day.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's just something that somehow is built into your makeup, because it doesn't involve a lot of people.
Yeah. Good answer. I like it.
There might be 30,000 people in the country who are really interested in caves. 30,000 or 40,000. What's that?
Yeah.
A small percentage of the total.
Yeah, very.
Caving is a cheap way of having a lot of fun.
It sure is. It sure is.
And it's great as long as you don't mind getting dirty.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Yeah. And
well, I'd like to just say that I really appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to you.
Well, it's fun, and I like a record made of what's been going on around here, you know.
Sure.
I just happen to be a part of it, a small part of it. You're a part of it. Sam Frischauer, you ought to get a hold of him.
I'd love to.
He's got a wild background. He went down and bought Blue Springs Caverns, right?
Yeah, sure did.
He was part owner of the darn thing.
Yeah.
And, of course, I bought Buckner Cave.
Two very different paths.
And Sam has a very remarkable background. And he was one of the Sullivan heirs.
Yeah.
And it's too bad you can't interview people like Bob Armstrong anymore.
I know. I was fortunate enough to talk to him at Cave Capers a number of years ago, just before he passed away. But he was a good guy.
No, he character. He's a real character, believe me.
Well, thank you, Dick. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks for coming out.
Oh, we went for 2.5 hours.
Yeah, I guess we did.
This is great.
Dick Blends, may he rest in peace. Thanks for listening. I'm Matt Pelser, chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto. Till next time, kill nothing but time.